Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Sarah Gon. Sarah, how are you?
I'm well. I'm enjoying being back on a sort of three-way split, shall we say.
Yes, no, good to have you back on the long version of the show. And we're also joined today by Chris Patterson. Chris, has also been a while since you were on. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Very good to have you back. Let's get into the first story of today. And this is one that I don't know if it's the most important story in the country, but man, is it entertaining. So let me lay it all out here. This is a report from News24. It's titled, Hlophe and Manyi Get Physical Over Sona Debate Speech Disagreement, MK Party Insiders Say. So according to this reporting, after the response to the State of the Nation debate in Parliament, the MK Party had an internal caucus where Jacob Zuma, who had been watching the speeches, came down to complain about the content of some of the speeches, saying that they spent too much time praising him as the president, and the implication here is that they should have spent more time attacking the ANC or the DA or you know, just going on offense rather than sucking up to him. I think this demonstrates once again, by the way, that Zuma remains a strategist who actually sort of knows how things should run rather than the fool that many people make him out to be. Unfortunately, his underlings sort of got very upset by this. Hlophe in his speech had called Zuma the best president ever, and according to the insider that was talking to News24, Zuma felt there was no need to praise his presidency during the debate and annoyed him that MPs praised him because he felt he did not need any praise. Hlophe then explained to Zuma that he had prepared his own speech, but at the last hour, Mzwanale Manyi went to him and gave him a different speech and said, no, this draft has been approved by Zuma. And then he claimed that this was the cause, that it wasn't his fault, it was Manyi's fault. When Hlophe learned from Zuma that the former president had nothing to do with the speech, he apparently felt betrayed by Manyi and confronted him during the caucus meeting. According to the source, things then got physical. The source said he grabbed Manyi by the neck and asked him why he had betrayed him like that. He also shared some very strong words with him. One can only imagine what those might have been. Apparently, a different anonymous source then said that Manyi tried to deflect the blame from himself, saying, no, he hadn't written the speech. He had just been given it by Floyd Shivambu, and that this, in fact, had not come from him, and that he was just the messenger, and he was being bullied unfairly here. When the spokesperson for MK was asked by the media for responses to this, he did not respond. But Jimmy Manyi said, well, there was a discussion, but nothing became physical. He said, quote, no, he didn't touch me. There's no such thing. They are lying. He said, if there was a confrontation that turned physical with one person physically handling the other or grabbing another by the neck, if that was the case, trust me, there would have been assault charge opened. But I can't lie and say there was no meeting. Yes, there was a meeting, but it was an internal matter of the MK party. Nothing was physical. It's just a discussion of mature people. He also described Hlophe as, quote, a decent fellow who is very respectable and argues his points maturely without becoming physical. Now, this is not the first story of this type from the MK party. We've covered on the show a voice note from Jacob Zuma complaining about MK party members bringing guns to party meetings to intimidate each other. There was allegations by the MK that one of their senior leaders in Mpumalanga had tried to hire an assassin to kill one of her rivals in the party. And there's the interesting fact, as you were reminding me just before the show, Sarah, that, maybe this did happen because John Hlophe does have a lot of rumors around him about exactly this sort of thing. What do you make of this story?
Well, just on the latter point, I mean, one has to remember a few years ago, not that many years ago, his deputy judge president of the Western Cape, Judge Goliath, laid a number of complaints against him, which included assaulting another judge. And somewhere in there were sexual harassment things. And all I can say is when you put together a party full of politicians who have absolutely not a moral concern in their bodies for their fellow South African human being. This is what you get. And the answer to this all is they're all lying, probably excepting this case, Zuma. They're all lying because he, Shropi has the temper that you say is, has been accused of other things in the past. I do suspect he, you know, the chances are that he did grab Jimmy Bunyan by the throat. I mean, the very fact that he said, you know, I must tell the truth, there was a meeting. You know that what he wanted to say was there was a meeting, but I wasn't going to admit that there was a meeting unless the media forced me to admit that there was a meeting. So it is as grubby as can possibly be, which is, as you say, hugely entertaining. But it also goes to an assumption I had when MK was formed and you started to see who was joining the party, that the personalities involved with the lack of morality involved would probably see the ultimate demise of the party. And when Jacob Zuma dies, between Floyd Shivambu, John Shlope, Duduzile Zuma Sambudla, and Jimmy Manya, and probably a whole host of other people, I think it's going to be the civil war we avoided 30 years ago.
Yes, well, hopefully it stays contained to the MK party and doesn't spill over. It's just, I was talking to my wife about this story actually just a couple hours ago, and I was trying to think of a good analogy for MK's big problem, and that's that it's essentially become a sort of a drip pan where everyone who's got a problem in society, who's got some sort of legal charge against them, who's been accused of some heinous crime, who has some sort of dodgy history, ends up in the party. And as it turns out, you know, no organization can function under those circumstances. You actually need some people who are truly committed to the cause and are not just there to, you know, play games, enrich themselves, or, you know, advance their own interests. And I think, you know, this is actually something the EFF has always benefited from, is that, you know, the EFF certainly has its casts of dodgy characters in the party, Malema being one of them, I think. But it still had true believers in its ranks, people who really honestly were there because they believed in the need for grand revolution in the country and, you know, some sort of communist state. I don't think MK has anything like that, at least not in its senior leadership. Chris, what do you make of this? You know, there's a lot of questions in our politics now, I think, about how sustainable MK is. Do you think this is going to hurt them, or will MK voters just shrug their shoulders and say, you know, we're voting for Zuma, we're voting for MK, it doesn't matter what the minions of Zuma are doing behind closed doors?
I don't think it matters to the average MK voter, because they effectively all there on Zuma's say-so. So, thinking of your drip pan analogy, I normally throw the drippings off into the toilet. That party is going to end up in one big mess when Zuma dies. And we can see, at least in comparison with the EFF, at least the EFF has a so-called democracy, that they have conferences every few years. Jacob Zuma seems to fancy no democracy at all. So, of course, there's going to be infighting every so now and then, and it's going to spill over into the public. And the South Africans are going to read it and laugh it off and look at our unserious opposition. When the GNU goes on and on and on and on, and there's no accountability, effectively.
I think, you know, I've recently been advocating for the DA to sort of become almost an opposition within government. Stay in the GNU, but be far more aggressive and assertive and oppositional within the government. And I think, you know, the sort of completely confused state of MK and the EFF right now really, I think, reinforce that point, is that, Chris, as you say, there is, you know, there's no one actually sort of properly doing the job of an opposition right now. I think there's some parts of the DA that are doing it, but I think the whole party kind of needs to get behind that, because, you know, right now, the so-called progressive caucus, which has disintegrated over the past couple of weeks, is just in total chaos. And there's no one who's actually keeping that adversarial eye on the government. Tara, what do you make of this?
No, I agree with you. I think essentially the DA is now reaching the point where it needs to up its muscularity in this, and particularly be, you know, as you say, the state of the MK and the diminishing fortunes of EFF have, if the DA says, you know, we're not going a step further on this, or you know, we're going to hold back on that, or we're going to accuse you of something else, the ANC's got no options, not even the ugly ones. The ugly ones are so ugly that they're, you know, irreconcilable.
But right, exactly. And, you know, how do you form a coalition government with MK? Good luck on to that.
Well, that's the point. You see, you've got to form coalitions ultimately with parties that do have one person leading the party, not 50 egos just sort of shuffling around and kowtowing and then not kowtowing and then fighting. It's, you know, the DA, look, in reality, the DA has to be seen to be more muscular without walking out of the GNU. It seems to have lost its sense of the moment, and it better get that back because it can afford to.
I think there's been a bit of push in that direction in a positive way. I think with their legal challenge to the expropriation bill, that's a very good sort of momentum regaining option here. I think some of the other GNU partners are also sort of squandering their position. You know, initially the Patriotic Alliance, the IFP, and the Freedom Front Plus all joined the DA in their opposition to the expropriation bill, but you know, they may have said more since then, but they really haven't been able to capture the public debate or sort of join up with the DA in opposition to that. And so I think there's just generally a failure of the sort of pro-property rights political parties to really capture the public debate. Although we'll talk about that more in a second, but go ahead, Sarah.
No, I was just going to say, you see, the problem that the DA has is it actually has structure, it has a leader, whatever one's opinions may be. But the advantages that those small parties have, which is kind of unfair, is that a Gayton McKenzie, or, you know, he's an obvious because he speaks whatever he wants, is he can, because he is the leader of the party. There's no one to gainsay him. So DA's problem is partly its democratic nature.
And I think that's where most of these smaller parties also get their media coverage from, when Gayton McKenzie comes out against illegal immigration, for example. That's how they get into the media. And if they're not in the media, then they're not in public, and the public can't get an opportunity to hear what they have to say.
Definitely. And I think they need to step up more, especially the IFP and the Freedom Front Plus on these issues. Okay. Let's move on to our next topic. And this is about the expropriation bill. President Ramaphosa was responding to the State of the Nation debate, which happens in Parliament after SONA every year. The DA criticized the government for the expropriation bill, saying that it would allow essentially what we at the IRR have been saying, which is the abuse of people's right to own property. And Ramaphosa said something quite interesting, but I'll explain why it was interesting. He said that there would be no land grabs on his watch, that given the history of land dispossession of land owned by black people, the government under him would never wanted to do the same. He said the country had a constitution that protected people's rights and property. He said, quote, "The people of this country know the pain of forced removals. That is why we will never allow forced removals again. This is why we have a constitution that prohibits the arbitrary deprivation of property. This is why we have a constitution that requires just and equitable compensation be paid in the event of expropriation for public purpose or public interest. Our experience of forced removals also explains the constitutional requirements that the state must take reasonable measures within its available resources to foster conditions which enable citizens to gain access to land on equitable basis." He said essentially then that the expropriation bill was necessary to transform land ownership in the country. Okay, Mr. President, if the Constitution really just protects us all here, it says that we need just and equitable compensation for the deprivation of property. If you're so committed to opposing the abuse of people, I mean, one of the great crimes of apartheid was that it denied millions, and pre-apartheid too, all the way back to the 1913 Land Act, is that it deprived black South Africans of the ability to have secure property tenure. Take the nil compensation bit of the expropriation bill out of the law. Send it back to Parliament. Get your party to rewrite that bill and take that bit out, because you're being disingenuous otherwise. You can't say on one hand, no, the Constitution protects everything, and then also include an open-ended list in the same piece of legislation that you're defending here, which says that you can provide nil compensation under these issues and also any other one we can come up with to justify in the public interest. The sort of NC is kind of trying to play both sides of this issue in a way. Sara, what do you make of this?
You know, the point is made that there have been land grabs. There have also been grabs of land by, I can't remember, provincial or local administrations in the most heinous way against, in those cases, black landowners or certainly people who have a right on who have rights on land. If they want to give ownership of land to people, give them title deeds to whatever they're on now or have been on for a period, if you know, if they want to put a period of time to it. That obviously administratively take a while, but that would be a transfer of ownership of land that would circumvent a whole lot of issues. So that's one thing. So I agree with you entirely. The other point is, I think Ramaphosa said somewhere along in the debate, he was talking about that, you know, he I think it was in response to the DA having said that, you know, he should get these bills or these acts rather should not have been passed. They hadn't, you know, that given the GNU, they should have been off the table or they shouldn't have been passed just as a sort of throwaway before the election. And Ramaphosa said, no, this is, he's obliged to do this. If the parliament puts forward a bill, he's obliged to assent to it. Unless it's unconstitutional. Well, holy moly, almost everything he's assented to is being challenged for being unconstitutional. And the very weakness of the man, the very sort of shallow elements of how he does his politics is that what he should have done is where big constitutional issues have been raised, and I know we've raised almost all of them ourselves, let alone everyone else who's done it, those bills should have gone back to Parliament, and they didn't. So, you know, it's the usual sort of Ramaphosa doughy-eyed puffery that's at play here.
Now, that's really well said. It's the sort of talking out of both sides of your mouth at the same time, you sort of saying, no, we care about property rights. We want a stable environment. We're not going to do anything arbitrarily. But also we're going to pass laws that effectively will allow the state to abuse its citizens more easily. Chris, your thoughts on this?
I find it quite interesting that the president mentioned land reform, because land reform has nothing to do with expropriation. And it's quite interesting. I found an oral reply to a National Assembly question from last year, and that oral reply stated that the government spent 23 billion rand processing land claims since 1998, and 90% of land claimants opt for compensation rather than physical land. So I don't know where the government comes on this need for land.
Right, exactly. This is a central point that's always overlooked in this discussion, is that government always claims that the real reason that we haven't had the great sort of land restitution justice issue that we have, you know, this skewed land ownership is because there's just all these farmers who are just holding on to land and trying to screw the government and not... That's not the reality. And it's also not true, as you say, that people out there are desperate for land, because as it turns out, most South Africans do not want to be a subsistence farmer on a communal farm. They want a house, they want a job, and they want the opportunity to live a modern and forward-looking life, not to live like a peasant from the 1800s, which is this kind of absurd fantasy that so many of the sort of radicals in South African politics always are projecting onto our people, is that, you know, apparently all South Africans out there, I've never met one, are desperate to, you know, grow 5 millis in their backyard and you know, live on a tiny farm hold. What's even more ironic about all of this is that the claim is always that this is restituting land to black South Africans. But of course, when you undermine everyone's property rights, you're also undermining the rights of black property owners too. It's one of the curiosities of for example, the EFF's policies, that that under an EFF government, the number of black landowners in South Africa would drop to zero because the state would own all the land. Anyway, Chris, final thoughts on this one?
I really don't have anything more to say. It's just that, the Expropriation Act, I mean, even I see the president mentioned District 6. My grandparents were forcefully removed from District 6. So I know what that meant to my grandmother and my parents, who now have been living on the Cape Flats for the past 50 years. My grandmother, God rest her soul, never got the opportunity to get her land back. So she was effectively denied her property rights, and I don't want that to happen to anybody else. I really don't.
Well said. Okay, let's go on to our next story, and this is about the water crisis in Joburg. It's sort of been hanging around there in the background, kind of bubbling away, or not bubbling away, I guess, is the case in this at the moment. But Joburg at the moment seems to be suffering under another widespread water outage. Sarah, I think you said you didn't have water recently. One of our colleagues, our producer of the show, Mbali, didn't have water. And I see the Gauteng High Court in Johannesburg has not had water recently, and in fact has had to shut down, according to Gauteng Judge President Dustin Mlombo and his deputy, Ronald Sutherland. They had no choice to shut down operations because the ongoing water shortage there was a, quote, big health hazard. The judge president said, it's a human rights issue and a big health hazard. Big. We don't have any water today at all. That's the issue. On other days, we would have had our tankers. We would have had water, even if there's no water elsewhere, but they've been depleted, so we could not have water for anyone. That's why we had to close the court, because of the health hazard it could present if we stayed there the whole day. It's being described by some of the people in the legal profession as a straight-up human rights abuse. And it is, I believe, a constitutional right of all South Africans to have access to water. And yet, you know, all the statements that come out of Rand Water and the Joburg government and the Tshwane government are sort of, it's temporary, don't worry about it. It's just, you know, I think the specific water outage has been caused by a power trip at the pumping stations. But these appear to be becoming ever more frequent. And I saw Rand Water recently claimed that Tshwane and Joburg were once again on the verge of collapsing their water infrastructure because they were simply demanding too much. Sorry, your thoughts?
Perhaps now that the High Court has decided informally that it is a human rights issue and it's been abused, perhaps the next judgment on the custodianship of a right, as they did with water and as they did with mining, should not go to the state to manage and leave us in the situation where essentially South Africans have to apply for permission to use water in whatever context they need to use water. And it's the bizarreness, I suppose, of everything that is wrong, that a constitutional right to water, which, you know, one would like to have a right, but it's very difficult to have a positive right to anything because everything depends on what the government of the day does with those rights. It's much, you know, in reality, you should only be having negative rights. In other words, you should not be killed by the state. You know, as soon as you start to create positive rights, healthcare, et cetera, it's actually entirely in the hands of any given government. And that includes water rights because we've got water. It's not that Joburg is in a drought. The water reserves are there, or they're available, but our infrastructure cannot get the water to us, and this is essentially the problem. And they can't get the water to us because the ruling party has not paid attention to the fact that water needs to flow down through pipes and pumps, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe if the High Court is angry enough, because it was the Constitutional Court that essentially ceded mining rights to the government as custodianship, which is also a potential problem in the Expropriation Act, or implied in the Expropriation Act, perhaps we'll have the judiciary on our side when we go battering down the legal doors.
Yeah, no, I think that's... That's a good reminder. Chris, your thoughts on this? I mean, you know, unfortunately, many rural towns across South Africa have, you know, faced this crisis years ago, but now we're seeing Joburg and Tshwane being hit with it. It seems to not be really going away. This seems to me like it's going to be a very big issue in the local government elections next year.
Oh, definitely. Municipal spending, municipal governments have been underspending on infrastructure for years. So the chickens are finally coming home to roost, and hopefully it will have an impact on the way people vote, because you can't not live without water. I mean, the High Court being without water is also, because it's closed, it's also impacting those people's access to justice. That court can't decide for some person that's going to court on some sort of matter. So the rights are being violated left, right, and center.
Sarah, any final thoughts?
Yeah, well, it does raise a whole lot of problems. You know, you haven't got water going to the court can't operate, and so the court can't dispense justice. So people are losing their right to the benefits of the rule of law. But there's an irony here that is just too much not to go mention, is if they need technology and know-how as to how to deal with water issues, particularly where there is no water, there are no people better to speak to than the Israelis.
Yes, although I don't think they've been in a particularly charitable mood at the moment for reasons that I think anyone who's followed the news would know. And I also don't think they're going to be asked anytime soon. Anyway. Go ahead, Chris.
I remember the ANC throwing up a big hoo-ha about Cape Town looking to invest into desalination plants just because they were Israelis. I mean, really? There's an option to get clean water, but you here with your ideological nonsense. Baffling.
No, exactly. Our government is really hitting a sort of a combo of self-inflicted wounds recently. It's quite horrifying to watch. Anyway, we keep making a fuss about it, and South Africans, I think you need to also keep making your voices heard so that we can see the changes we need in our country to turn around these many crises that we are facing. Anyway,
can I just
that's all the time. Yeah, go ahead, sir.
You know, we've been very informative and very entertaining, but you know, the budget's coming up, which may be informative and may be crucial, but it's not going to be that entertaining. But if you wanted to relieve pressure by having a smoke of the, you know, of the good rolled stuff, I'm afraid the supply that came out of the Khoisan camp at the Union Buildings is no longer. The plants have been removed. The people have been evicted. Apparently, you know, peacefully, eventually been evicted. So supplies of the stuff that's going to get you through a budget where there's not enough, going to be not enough money for anything. Guys, you're going to have to go elsewhere.
That camp at the Union Buildings was what, had been there for 7 years, am I correct in saying?
That's right.
It's a fascinating example of South Africa's political culture and just how, you know, sometimes we can be a fairly relaxed bunch of people. this kind of in front of the president's residence or office. This went on for 7 years. And it ended, you know, without anyone being beaten with a truncheon or manhandled into a police car, thankfully.
It also had to be done under a DA, a Minister of Public Works.
Oh, yes, that too. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We hope you found this show interesting. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend ahead. And we will see you next week on The Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone.